This is Judge Jones and Steve Bean, and when I'm not getting all pasty living in Judge Terry Olson's shadow, I'm half listening to the Emmy award-winning podcast, Spellburn.
Hark, O mighty one, our sacrifice begins. We commence.
Welcome to Spellburn, a podcast about the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. It's time to party like it's 1974.
Like many listening, I first encountered the mysterious world of Aerith in the pages of the DCC RPG core book. Many listening will remember the world of Aerith from back in the days when Dungeon Crawl Classics wasn't the name of a role-playing game, but was instead the name of a line of adventure modules written for the world's first fantasy role-playing game. Today we are lucky enough to have the man who quite literally wrote the book on the topic of Aerith, or at least co-wrote it, back in those days of yore. He's here to talk to us about the system's default setting and how it has changed since DCC RPG was launched. I'm Judge Jeff, and with me is Judge Jen.
Good evening, guys.
And Judge Julian.
Hello.
And if you haven't figured it out yet, our guest judge for this episode is the co-author of DCC number 35, The Gazetteer of the Known Realms, adventure writer extraordinaire, and friend of the podcast, Mr. Harley Stroh.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yay!
It's good to have you back on here, Harley. Yes.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it's a treat.
So we can go ahead and get into this episode here. So let's head on over to Tavern Talk.
Welcome, friends. Good to see you.
I only had one drink to calm my nerves.
Innkeeper, a drink of your most expensive.
Tavern Talk.
Well, here we are in Tavern Talk, and this is the segment where we talk about what we've been up to in gaming in this past week or so. Harley, do you mind starting us off?
I'd be happy to. So I have one of my friends is a board member on the local library, and she convinced the library to reach out to me, and we've started a local, they think it's a D&D group, but I'm actually running Dungeon Crawl Classics because, you know, it's like Xerox or Kleenex. Nobody understands that there's more to role-playing games than Dungeons & Dragons. And so, so I'm running DCC for a bunch of fifth graders, and if you've ever, or rather, if you've never had the chance to run a game for children before, like, they are the most wonderful, delightful murder hobos that you could ever imagine. Like, we have these random kids, and they're all in. Like, you know, like, we set the stage really early that, you know, your PCs are going to die, but don't worry about it. You know, you're never going to be out of the game. We'll always make up new characters. And right now we're going through sailors, and
of course,
one kid is just like lost, like, 8 PCs at this point, and you know, and the party is split in two, and it's just a, you know, it's a joy. There's the one kid, you know, who you know, we're making, I don't know, stat checks or something, and then all of a sudden I call for a luck check, and he's like, okay, so I'm gonna roll, you know, 1d20 plus my luck. I'm like, no, you have to roll under. And I saw that light go off in his eyes, like, no, that's not how the mechanic works. I'm like, oh, dude. you have a future. Like, this is awesome. Like, you're able to, you're recognizing these patterns within the game, and you're like, this is different. Why is this different? And anyhow, so yeah, what That's am I doing? Amazing. I'm running games for kids, and nothing can make me happier. It's such a joy.
So Harley, when you're running Sailors on the Starless Sea, do you have the module open? Are you checking things, or is this just all from your bean?
No, you know, I have Doug's map, and you know, from that we just play from there. Yeah,
cool. I like
How
it.
Long are those sessions usually?
You know, that was the trickiest part. So I get out of work, I try to make up to the library by about 4:30, and they're only open till 7. And so, you know, we just hustle. We crank as much in 2.5 hours as we can.
Oh, that's cool.
That's very cool.
I can't wait for them to level up. It'll probably take like half the session, but like, because they all came into it thinking, all right, we're going to have powers, right? I'm going to be a wizard. I'm going to be a, you know, a warrior. And they're like, no, you guys have nothing. Here's a pitchfork. But they're kids, so it's like, you know, they adjust to it. You know, like, it's like five seconds of, like, cognitive dissonance. And they're like, all right, I got a pitchfork. Now what do I do? And, like, to actually give them class powers that they can, like, kind of play the game they're expecting to play is really exciting. Anyway, sorry about that.
No. Not adults who can't make that switch that quickly.
That's going to be like Christmas for them, actually. That's really fun. That's going to be like, okay, now you can cast all six of these spells. They're going to be like, wow.
Right? It's such a treat, dude. And like, you know, like it just brings you, I mean, I know you guys know this because you're on Spellburn, but it brings you back to like, man, when I was in the Caves of Chaos and I first found that Cloak of Elvenkind, that blew my mind. And like, you know, like these kids haven't found any magic items yet, like nothing that like is remotely cool that isn't out to kill them. And when they actually get something that, like, you know, they're all going to kill each other over it. Like, they've already, like, there's, like, inter-party conflict over the, you know, the squire's, like, longsword.
Oh, jeez.
Like, somebody got a pitchfork in the back for the longsword. They were like, who gets to loot my character's body? I'm like, well, whoever's there. And, like, the one kid, he started writing wills for all his characters, like bequeathing all the related stuff back to his own characters, so he couldn't get looted by his compatriots. Like, well, your character's illiterate, and so, you know, you can write your will, but nobody else can read it, and even if they could read it, just be gobbling. it's just like every other DCC game. You know, it's so beautiful. Like, kids, you know, they spend their whole lives, not their whole lives, but like they, you know, up to this point, it's just been like adults tell them what they can and they can't do. And for them to like exist in this world, this imaginary world where they can do whatever the hell they want, like, it's crazy at first. Like, they behave really poorly because they can do whatever they want. And then they learn to, I mean, there's a freedom that enables them to make good choices. I don't know. It's just awesome.
It wasn't in the old AD&D character sheet. Some of them had an actual section for the will. Do you remember this?
Dude, the very last line on page two.
And that's amazing.
I've never seen that. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Go and check it was my AD&D folder, Jeff.
It takes me right back to the 80s right there.
That is so cool. So, Julian, what have you been up to?
Well, I had a super fun Con of the North here, President's Day weekend, with Big John Dahlstrom, Jolly John Carnes, and no nickname Gary Fortoyne. And I don't know. I actually, he has a lot of nicknames, but I'm not going to share. So we had a great time. I ran Hive of the Overmind which was a really fun session. They, as you know, Jeff, and we talked about, I think, on the last episode, it can be quite deadly.
Yes, it
can. This group actually played really smart. And they went all in fighting the ants after a little hesitating, and they got super lucky. The dice just loved them. So then they got a little cocky, and then in the middle, they decided they were badasses, and needless to say, the dice stopped loving them. And then it got really dark really fast, just kind of swung around in a heartbeat. Which ended up being kind of a funny little fortune, reversal of fortune, as they say. So we didn't finish in 4 hours, but they got about two-thirds of the way, and it was not looking good. They were down to about four guys with about, you know, 40% of the adventure left to play.
Oh,
so, yeah, it was probably not going to work out great for them. But anyway, I ran Outlive, Outlast, Outkill, and that was probably my most fun table. They were very funny. They cooperated till the very end, and then turned into a bunch of random murder hobos. And you could kind of see in their eyes that they were all just waiting, and then it just got super reality TV at the end, and that was awesome. So I love the PvP. That was actually really fun, and that went down like just like it should, so that was fun. I ran this playtest of this American adventure. I'm doing Burger Wars for Reed Sanfilippo, and this is the first time I've run it, and it was really fun, really nutty and weird and kind of cheesy, no pun intended. The players embraced that and had a great time, and just kind of messing around with the world and interactive. It's kind of a hex crawl or a point crawl or whatever you might call it, or a sandbox maybe, since it all takes place in one city. But they had a great time just running around doing stuff, And then I ran a – the last thing I did was a AD&D game. I ran The Lone Tower by Janelle Jacques, Jacques, or I'm not sure how to say her name exactly.
I think it's Jacques.
Jacques.
Awesome.
Wow. And from the old Book of Treasure Maps. So I've gotten a lot of mileage just out of that little Book of Treasure Maps. And we ran for about 5 hours. And they pretty much finished it up. It was a nail biter. I don't want to. I shouldn't do too much spoilers, but they basically cleaned it up. But at the end, a worse monster was coming for them, and they lived at least as far as we could take it in the time that we had. So that worked out great. And she's. I mean, what can you say? That was just a great adventure. So we had a blast. Con of the North is a lot of fun. We had our own little room for the DCC, the Minneapolis DCC RPG Society. And we ran a lot of DCC, a lot of older games, a lot of MCC. John Carnes ran his Escape from the President's Hall. Ooh. And Dahlstrom ran his Time Bandits of Aerith, which people always enjoy the hell out of. We had a great time. Marvel and Gary ran a bunch of the old Marvel Phase Rip system.
Very cool. And Jen, what have you been up to?
Sadly, not a whole lot in the way of DCC, at least at the table. Our Star Wars game rebooted, and we're in the final stages of fighting the Queen of the Demon Web Pits, which means those first ed characters are about to be retired, which kind of interesting timing on that all around for social dynamics. But with the editing, there's been a lot of DCC Lankmar research and prepping for the games I'm going to be running at GaryCon that are all Lankmar. And I must admit that going over Journey to the Center of Aerith and the associated materials for tonight's show have actually sparked a couple ideas that I would love to pick Harley's brain on later. For, you know, campaign play.
What Lankmar adventures are you running?
I am running, I believe it's Blasphemy and Larceny, although it got titled Burglary and Blasphemy or something to that sort. It's a 5th level DCC Lankmar adventure that, of course, hasn't been released yet, but I got permission. And running that twice, and running one that I've put the seeds together and haven't actually put a whole lot on paper. So that's my job for the weekend.
Is this the one that I played in?
It is.
Cool. That's a fun one.
It's only 3rd level, but I think the 5th level one will be a little bit more challenging.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Well, I just finished running the 3rd in my 6-part Mutant Crawl Classics mini campaign, where we're running through all of the modules. And this one was Michael Curtis's Incursion of the Ultra Dimension. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. And sticking with Mr. Burnick's theme of crazy lethality, man, Incursion of the Ultra Dimension is the most fatal or most lethal non-funnel I've ever run. And I can't believe how foolish I was, because while I was reading it, I remember at one point thinking, like, oh, this seems like this is going to be kind of easy. I was kind of thinking that while I was reading it. And then when I actually ran it, we had 6 second-level characters die.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
So did you repopulate?
Well, yeah, we did. So, because basically what I'm doing is, at the end of the first adventure, Hive of the Overmind, everybody escaped in this vehicle, which I'm not going to share about because it's kind of a spoiler. But the kind of the theme of the continuing of the campaign is they're trying to get back to their home village in this vehicle. And at this moment, it's run out of gas, and they're trying to get some additional power sources. And they come up, and then they experience this adventure here. So what ended up happening is all but one of them died. There's this area where there's a grove of trees, and I won't say more than that. But all but one died there.
and I had him when he left a few of his friends who had been wondering what was taking so long, ended up rejoining to help him finish the adventure. So they did go back in, and they didn't complete it. It was way too deadly. But they did manage to find what was essentially the treasure room and leave there with a ton of goodies. So that's something. So hopefully they'll be a little more bulked up and prepared when we run the third level adventure for MCC. So that'll be fun. And also, Hoy ran one of his sessions of the Portsmouth Mermaid. Wait, is that right? Portsmouth Mermaid? Yeah. And he's doing his campaign sessions for the meetup group a little different than I am, because mine are, every session is one adventure. If it's a ginormous adventure, I just cut a lot of crap out so that the whole thing can happen in one session. If it's a really tiny adventure, I add a lot of fake, so I just make up a lot of stuff and throw stuff in there so that it ends up becoming one session. He's really kind of like letting each module he's running really kind of breathe. And he started with the Prince Charming Reanimated, or Prince Charming Reanimator, and then did Creeping Beauties of the Wood, and now he's doing the Portsmouth Mermaid. And I hadn't been able to attend a lot of the sessions, but I did get to go to this one, and it was a lot of fun. And yeah, that's what I've been doing, other than starting my prep work for Gearicon Adventures. That's it.
So have Hoy's sessions been averaging about like two sessions to a mod?
No, longer. I think like four sessions to a mod.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I ask because, of course, the first year and a half that I was doing this, I tried to do the same thing. And, you know, you cannot run the One Who Watches From Below in a single session. I mean, you can if you're at a convention, but if it's a campaign play, I really want the characters to get everything out of it that they can. And, you know, give them more chances to die. And I think that took us 2 to 2.5 sessions, and I was running 6-hour blocks back then.
Wow. Yeah, and see, I'm the one who managed to run both Doom of the Savage Kings and Dragora's Dungeon in single sessions.
And the Emerald Enchanter took 2.5 sessions, man.
No, but I've done the same. I've run Sailors like 4 times in one session, and I ran Doom in one session, and nice. Croaking Vane. I mean, you just, when we talk sessions, these are 5 to 5.5 hour. Like, I'm at my home table, so yeah. not tightly regulated convention
and not
sessions,
not up to 10 players at a table either.
That's true.
No,
ours are actually pretty tightly regulated because we start playing at 4, and Brooklyn Strata just closes at 8. So we've got a hard out after 4 hours. But I will say that when I ran Dragora's Dungeon, the villain was not Dragora, it was Dragor. And Dragor was very scantily clad. And every time you hit, anytime you hit him for additional damage, more armor fell off.
That's awesome.
And his AC slowly got better and better, or slowly got worse and worse as you were fighting him.
But I hope he was still wearing like a bikini.
Skull copies? Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, God. Woven out of chainmail. No, thanks.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for that. That was fun. Let's head on over to summon email.
I call upon the flame to summon you.
A hole delivered a message for me.
I came here to give you these facts.
Summon email.
Okay, and here we are in summon email, where we're going to work our way through this mailbag. I'm going to dig in here and pull the first one out. It looks like we've got one here from Mark Eisenheimer, and it says, "Hey, Spellburn Band. I recently started judging DCC. I really love most of the design ideas behind DCC, and especially its concept of world building and mystery. I felt inspired to create my own world/setting for DCC, and after years of experience with Pathfinder, its official campaign world, The Dark Eye, the German RPG, some D&D campaign worlds, and many, many more, I'm now wondering, how do you make a fleshed-out setting that keeps the wonder and mystery of DCC, the wonder and mystery that DCC wants from its setting? because most of these settings are charmful in its own way. They are clustered with history and events and commons that characters should know about when jumping into a new setting. This obviously is not what DCC is best at, because everything should be unique and mysterious. So here is my main question. When you, as judges, read about a new setting, how much knowledge about the world do you need or want in order to run a smooth game or campaign? How do you, as DCC players, want to perceive the world you play in? So this is kind of a great email for this episode.
It is.
Jen, do you want to dive in and let us know what you think about this?
I think, first off, I would have to counter with, am I running this setting as a one-shot, or am I going to be in it for an extended period of time? Because that will dictate how much I feel like I need to go in and dig through all the details and flesh out some NPCs and just create this place. If it's a one-off, I'll get what I need, make it up on the go for the rest of it.
Somebody, on this topic a long time ago, somebody in some internet forum or something pointed out that when you read a, fantasy novel or whatever, you don't get the entire history of the world in the first chapter or the introduction or whatever, and usually not, of course, even in the novel itself. The trick is, of course, even with something like Tolkien, which is elaborately detailed and so on, the trick is to give just enough information and color and detail to make you feel the context of the world behind the action, right? So you don't necessarily need 1,000 pages of detail behind it. You just need people to have the tone and the feel and a few names of this and a few factions of that, and the government is like this, and there's also some, magic users like that or something, and that's enough, really. So, and you can, if they for some reason want to mess around with the ruler, well, then you can build out the ruler and his armies and the cast of characters around the throne. Or if they want to find out how to use sorcery, then you can, flesh out the Mage's Guild and you start working in that direction. And you, just wherever they go, you kind of flesh that out as you go. And I think that's kind of generally the way to do it. Now, I really had a great time recently when I ran the Burger Wars game, even at the convention. I had them kind of answer questions, which I'll kind of typically do if you're really lazy. And I just had the players answer the questions like, okay, you're in a new town. What happened in the last town? And the first guy said, well, we were chased out. And I said, okay, great. Why were you chased out? And he said, well, we got in an argument. We had a bad argument. Well, whose fault was it? Well, it was the robot's fault. Okay, great. It was the robot's fault. Why was it the robot's fault? And just going around the table. So the fourth guy's like, well, the robot really got lippy with somebody. Okay, great. Well, who did the robot sass then, And they're like, it was at Wally World. The robot sassed the manager at Wally World, and then we all got thrown out of whatever, Peoria or wherever. Anyway, but by the time we got around it, we had this little bit of context, kind of like we had just had an adventure 2 weeks ago, and the whole rest of the way, we were like, oh, don't let the sassy robot talk, like we'd all been gaming together for 3 months.
That's so great.
What a beautiful way to drive home the idea of cooperative storytelling.
And it's just so Appendix N as well, because I feel like so many of the Fafford and Grey Mouser stories and so many of the Conan stories start with him, with him or them leaving some kind of previous adventure.
Right.
Well, I can't take credit for that. These guys were right on the money. I mean, they just had that whole shebang right down. So yeah, they were quite good. They were a great group. But let the context emerge and don't be afraid to let the players help you in that regard.
That's really cool. Harley, what do you think about this?
Well, I think in my opinion, part of what we love as judges is, in our downtime when we're not running games, we're still daydreaming about our games and fleshing out a world. Like, you can't help yourself in a lot of ways. But I think it depends less on the world, whether it has no detail and you're making it up all as you go, or it has just a ton of detail and the rates of travel and the, migrations of people. I think perhaps the most important thing is to have, player-facing levers, if that makes any sense, where, you know, if it needs to be like Conan doesn't enter any town and not be the focus of attention. Like, he is the he is the only disruptive antisocial force that has come through in the last 10 years, and they may never see him again, but by his very presence upsets the normal social order, whether it's just the bar room or whether it's the, you know, the wizard's tower. And I think one of the beauties of DCC is that all our PCs, you know, a band of PCs should be a disruption to the social order. Not meaning like they're murder hobos out to get the mayor, but they're just by their very presence, they represent a nucleus of power which causes the world to react to them. Like it's not and, you know, not to cast aspersions on any other settings, it's not Elminster sending them off to, you know, do his bidding or return with the wand of magic, you know, missile. It's, well, by virtue of your presence here, you know, stuff is going to come crashing down and change, and you know, whether it's like you know, Doom of the Savage Kings and the locals are like they're worked up into a froth because of your very presence, or, you know, whatever it is, like you know, the like I've long been an advocate of, you know, there's only one, well, the PCs are the only one of that character class in the world at that time. So like there's lots of soldiers in the world, but your fifth level warrior is the only guy who gets a mighty deed die in the world at that time, because he's just that badass. And there's lots of priests and people that walk around, you know, saying prayers, you know, day and night, but only your character can create miracles that can, you know, bring the dead, you know, back to life, or restore sight to the blind. And like, and when you start to think of your PCs in that way, like, you know, if a third level cleric comes into town, that's a huge thing. Like, who is this guy? How can he create miracles like this? And yeah, there's an evil you know cultist over there that, you know, can sacrifice 50 people and, you know, and create lightning storms, but just by his very nature, this guy prays to some, you know, otherworldly deity, and all of a sudden, like, you know, shit's going down. And so to place that sort of importance upon our player characters, you know, starts to define, you know, the setting, and how, you know, the PCs are as big of a part of the game as the setting itself, if that makes any sense.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I'm a big fan of, especially with DCC, not going into the game with like a whole tome of kind of backstory that I want to tell or express in the game that I'm running. You know, it's like there's this really cool role-playing game called Microscope that you guys may or may not know about. And for those listening, Microscope is the role-playing game where the whole purpose of the game is you come up with a setting together, essentially. And it's a fun game. I really enjoy it. But when I wanted to run my first campaign for DCC, one of my players really wanted us to have a Microscope session before we played. And I was very much against it because I didn't want us to all kind of come together and codify the setting and figure it all out beforehand. I really wanted us to be able to explore it through play. You know, I feel like when I think of world building for DCC, I really like the Eyes of the Overworld style. You know, it's like Kujel is like flung across the continent, and he's just kind of hitting town to town. And every new town he goes to, they have no idea what's in the next town. And they have all these like crazy rumors about what's over there. And he gets to the next town, and some of those rumors are true, some of them are not. But he's really finding out about the setting by exploring it. And I feel like that's kind of, in my mind, the spirit of DCC.
Like you run a game, and one spell misfire goes bad, or there's like a major corruption, then all of a sudden the game has an entirely new focus. Like, it really rewards... it doesn't, well, yeah, it reinforces the ability to think on the fly. Like,
oh yeah,
you need to be able to change, you know, like all of a sudden my wizard has tentacles coming out of his mouth. What are we going to do about that? Like, we don't care about saving the elf kingdom anymore.
Yeah. I want to get rid of these tentacles. Right.
Exactly. It's like when I was in Jen's game at Brinkmanomicon that she's running again at Garrickcon. You know, I was a third level wizard who ended up exploding an entire section of Lankmar with their color spray spell.
I was just really happy that our time slot was up anyway, because I wasn't sure where to go from there.
Exactly, but a setting like Forgotten Realms, you're not going to have some third-level wizard blow up a whole section of Waterdeep. You know, like, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, and if you did, people would be pissed. Whereas exactly. In DCC, it's like, all right, well, you know, it was Brendan's email, you know, from
National,
which is so brilliant, right? Like, okay, you know, Jeff annihilated one third of Nightmare. All right, let's lean in. What are the logical repercussions of this?
You know, and, exactly. And they're not good. And
none of them are good.
But it places so much more preeminence upon the PCs as actual, you know, motive powers and agitators in this world, as opposed to, you know, shadow puppets, you know, performing on the stage that, you know, the judge chose. Session.
Hey. Jeff, you got me like 49% of the way committed to running DCC in Waterdeep and letting it all just go to hell. Like, you know, I mean, seriously, I want it like session 4, tentacles coming out of Elminster's mouth, Waterdeep exploding, and, you know, the whole 9 yards.
Oh, please. I want to be a part of that.
We could set up a hangout game for that, right?
Yeah.
I don't think I go deep enough with Waterdeep, no pun intended, to make that happen.
All right. So, thank you so much for your email, Mark. Jen, do you want to go ahead and dive into our next one?
Okay. It looks like this one comes from our friend Judge Julio. First of all, I wanted to thank the G+ DCC Music Group and the inspiration they transmitted. I am going to start 2018 with Rainbows/Dio's music, Stargazer, as an adventure, with the PCs as zero-level brainwashed slaves, suddenly realizing that they are working at the construction of the Stargazer's tower. So, the question... At the occupation table in the core rulebook, there's only a 30% chance of playing with a demi-human. If DCC was made to stand out as a weird and different game, why do we keep the standards of human beings more populous? I don't see why we couldn't have an elf alchemist or dwarf cobbler or halfling gong farmer, just to say stereotypical ones. Also, I know somewhere in the book it says if your players really want to play with a demi-human, you should let it, but it takes the fun of randomness out of generating a zero-level character. So what are your suggestions on fixing that? And he signs off, Happy Holidays, and may your 2018 have awesome games. So, hey, we're not as far behind on our mailbag as we thought. Julian, you want to take that one first?
I think the reason that we go with the trope of humans being more populous is because that's kind of the Appendix N inspiration in DCC, and, you know, we're leaning back toward that Liber and Howard world where, in fact, there were no elves, sort of a pre-Tolkien sensibility, pre-elf, pre-dwarf type of thing. Even though it's a D&D thing, it's not an Appendix N thing per se, at least not for the authors that came before Tolkien. And that was probably in the spirit of most of Gygax and Arneson's inspirations originally. Having said that, you know, Julio, of course, it's your game and you bought it and you can do anything the hell you want with it. So, you know, if you want to have the first thing that pops into my mind, you can absolutely do anything you want. But if you want to make it more random in an interesting way and have more demi-humans, the first thing I would do is roll randomly to get an occupation, ignore the racial part of it. And then additionally, roll a d5 to determine evenly whether you're human, dwarf, elf, halfling, or orc. And then just have that and then be done with it. Or, you know, that's just pops into my brain at the first idea. But, of course, you can do any variant of that or something totally different. The rules are yours to fit to your campaign. So don't – if you like the spirit of the randomness, keep that. But – change the table to give results more in line with what you want.
There's no shortage of occupation tables floating around there that are, you know, fan sourced.
Yeah, I would, my response to this would be, when everything is weird, nothing is weird. So I actually think that when you have too many demihumans, you lose a lot of the weirdness. I think that DCC and other fantasy role-playing games are far weirder when humans are really the main kind of sentient race, and everything that they encounter really is super alien and monstrous. That's my brief answer to that.
You know, and yeah, the only thing I would add, you know, to what you guys have said is that Purple Sorcerer Games, you know, their generator, they are always awesome about, they will add your like native homeworld occupation table to their generator so it could be on a drop down menu. So, you know, if any listeners are so inspired, they should always be like generating their own, you know, 1D1000 tables and sending them over to Mr. Marr, and he can add them to their generator. It's like,
poor John.
It's one of the coolest. No, it's like, if you follow the template, I believe it's just a cut and paste. I could be totally wrong, Mr. Marr. I'm totally sorry if I'm wrong. But it's such a sweet, like, that was like the first thing I did when you know, when John advertised this. It's like, oh my God, I got to send him like a Boon Jar generation table. This makes me feel so real. Yeah. So yeah, like just building off of, you know, what you guys said. But Jen, do you have any thoughts on it?
I'm pretty much in line with what you folks have said. I'm a huge fan of do what your players want, but make sure that you have fun too.
Yeah, that's great. So I do feel like we're running low on time in our mailbag section, but that said, this last one is so incredibly short. And I think we could all answer it in a very, very quick, concise way. So I say we go for it. So this is from Twitter. So maybe our own response can be 144 characters or less. Julie, do you want to read this one for us?
Yes. Yes, please. It looks like it's from Tom Lichty at Tominating on the hashtag Snap Twitter or whatever that is. I don't know.
Technology,
I hear about
you
things
know.
Like this. Yeah. Okay. At Spellburn, how many death traps is too many death traps in a funnel? Well, if something's still moving, there weren't enough.
Well said. Mine would be super lethal death trap at the beginning just to keep them on their toes.
Mm.
I would say when your players start crying and going home.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Did anybody see the guy has actually, he created a random generator of MCC characters via Twitter so that he can,
and
he can hit a button.
Like kill the you told him to kill the PCs off.
Yeah, he said, so it was like really cool. He is randomly tweeting like, you know, Aethera is a first level mutant with three eyes and she found a laser pistol and discovered that she has telekinesis. And I was like, dude, they've got to die messily at least 50% of the time. So then he updated it and it's like, Aethera is a second level mutant with a laser pistol who died trying to figure out how a magna clamp works or something. And so now, yeah. And now they're just even way funnier. It's really pretty neat, though, what this guy has done. So check it out.
Very cool. And Harley, do you have a quick 144 character or less response for Mr. Tom Lichty here?
You know, it just has to be true to the logic of the world. Like, if there's no way into the wizard's tower, if the wizard didn't want anybody to get in, it's stupid. If there's a secret door in the last death trap to get into the wizard's tower.
Mm. I like it. Okay, and with that, we're going to head on over to Mighty Deeds.
Let the combat begin! To the death!
Why, behold, our hero.
Huh, so you want to play rough, eh? Well, take this!
Mighty Deeds.
Okay, here we are in Mighty Deeds, and we're here to discuss Aerith, the default setting in DCC RPG. But Bugbabills, Cesar Khan, and Justicia all come from here, but it's clear to anyone who plays DCC RPG and who has read The Gazetteer of the Known Realms that the setting has changed quite a bit since then. Today we are lucky enough to have Harley Stroh here, who can help us answer these questions we might have about the setting, where it came from, how it's changed, and how we use it today. So, Harley, tell us a little bit about Aerith. When did you first encounter this setting?
Well, around 2004. Goodman Games is going gangbusters. We had, you know, nearly 30 DCCs, if you can believe that. DCC Adventures.
I can believe it because this was number 35.
Yeah.
Smartass.
But you know, and all the DCCs, you know, then as and now, were written to be easily dropped into, you know, an evening's gaming. There's no curious or strange setting requirements, and you know, there's nothing precluding any DCC to be dropped into Forgotten Realms or Greyhawk or possibly Eberron, you know, whatever have you, Mystara. And so Joseph came to me and he said, you know, we have these 30 adventures and let's make a world out of it. And so, you know, myself and Jeff LaSala, Mike Ferguson, the three of us started combing through all of the DCCs and every capitalized name, if it was a town, if it was a deity, if it was a magic item. We started to collate all these, and then out of that, we built Aerith.
Wow.
Very cool.
I can only imagine the scope of that.
So, Harley, are there some of the more kind of iconic people from, or the kind of more iconic characters from the core book, like Cesar Khan, Bubugba Bills, were any of those characters that you had created previously?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and that's the really cool thing about DCC RPG. Like, you start to dive into those names. So Cesar Khan is mine.
Cool.
I think it first appeared in Tower of the Black Pearl, which is part of the Adventure Begins compilation. Bubugba Bills came out of Crypt of the Devil Lich. Justicia, I think she was also in Crypt of the Devil Lich. All these yeah. OB2K, you know, that was DCC 17. All these names, you know, that we take for granted and struggle to pronounce today, many of them, appeared previously, because all these authors were writing without a setting reference. And so if any one of us wanted a God of War... And this started to get obnoxious at one point. If any one of us wanted to write a God of War, we all created our own God of War. Yeah. It's like, enough already,
oh,
dudes.
Oh, man.
Like, you know, right. But this
kind of served as a style guide, too.
To the degree that anybody read it who was writing DCCs.
Good point.
But, So Jeff LaSala, he's probably he's the author of 11 or so DCC related stuff. He worked on Eberron. He wrote a novel for that for Wizards of the Coast. Now he works for Tor. Like this guy is like a lore god, you know. Whereas I'll write something and I won't remember how to spell Cesar Khan the next day. Jeff, you know, if you see anything in the history of Aerith, that's because Jeff put it together. At one point in time, he and I did a Dragonborn. I think it was 4E. Yes, we did a Dragonborn book for Goodman Games, and it's not he created a language. It's like it's not enough for him to like write the fluff and then move on. He's going to create something that has has hooks and teeth in it. And so it was his idea. So I smartly assigned him, you know, the history, all the gods. And so he started to create these pantheons where, you know, if the elves have a god of war. Well, that a god is above and beyond, you know, like, you know, any particular, you know, species or race or what have you. So the half-orcs might be praying to the same thing that the elves are praying to when they're, you know, out to annihilate one another. And so that was a way of kind of condensing and collecting and collating the gods so that we didn't have 800 gods of war. They're you know, humankind or dwarven kind has 800 names for, you know, the god I'm going to beseech to, you know, beat the crap out of the guy next to me. And but we're actually all praying to the same thing. Anyhow, so the point being, so you go through, you know, the gazetteer or the GM's guide, and it has a lot of that source material that eventually got ported, that Joseph used when he created, you know, DCC RPG and, you know, started pulling these names for, you know, who these people were praying to.
I believe the large list there, I'm looking at pages 18 and 19, and since some of the names were kind of familiar, I printed those pages out and handed them to my original players who were asking for more information on people like Justicia.
Totally. And if you have access to the Word docs like I did for all the previous DCCs, you can dive even deeper and in Crypt of the Devil Lich, you know, there's a 500, you know, word count, you know, sidebar, you know, dedicated to Justicia, which was the original, you know, reference for her.
Now, in your mind, is the Aerith of DCC RPG the same Aerith of the Gazetteer?
Definitely not. When I'm writing these days, you know, I'm thinking less about Aerith, you know, with the exception of Poonjar, obviously, and more about DCC at its finest, and I'll bounce this off of you guys, not at its finest, at its purest sense, is kind of a mythological setting where, like, you grew up next to a lake. There's a thing in the lake. Sometimes it gives you a golden sword, and sometimes it comes and eats your children. And that's the only instance of that particular monster in the multiverse.
Yeah.
And whatever you choose to cause that, you know, call that monster, you know, be it Mother Grendel or, you know, the silky and the, you know, beneath the waves or whatever have you, you know, like it has that. It kind of dives back down to that mythological sense of all these creatures, all these anomalies are, you know, ideally, you know, referencing the place, you know, referencing, you know, a specific set of tragedies, you know, referencing, you know, what that, you know, that that is distinguished greatly from the World of Aerith, which is a collection. You know, it harkens back more to, you know, like the World of Greyhawk, which I just absolutely adore, you know, Forgotten Realms, you know, Mystara, these worlds which are extrapolations of, well, yeah, they're extrapolations of adventures, just like Aerith is, you know, so a DCC, you could imagine, you know, taking, you know, the World of Aerith and stripping it down into a 32-page, like, document which just bullets, like, this is the unique thing that's here. This is the unique monster that's here. You will never find a Minotaur anywhere else but here. And you know, there's one dragon, you know, like, that would be a beautiful thing. And that would really, like, really hold true to both the origins of Aerith and also, like, that vision of DCC, the RPG.
Is it kind of a conscious choice, Harley, though? Like, in DCC... we're going to be meta. Your players don't even know a damn thing about the king. You know, they live 300 miles away, and they never expected that they leave their village. So we're not going to explain it to the players either. You know, in that same spirit of not codifying monsters, because the players nor the characters know a damn thing about a monster, they also don't really need to know a damn thing about the king or anything beyond Justicia is a god of justice and so on. You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
I mean, is that
totally,
in the...
Totally.
Is it kind of like, well, we just didn't do that? Or is it kind of like, well, this is really kind of in our design?
Meaning DCC RPG, it's in the design? Or
yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you could also imagine a world where you and I were back in high school, we had a lot of time on our hands because we, you know, we're not on the football team, or we're certainly not dating anybody. And so there's that village out in the middle of nowhere that hasn't seen anybody for 20 years, and you and I know that, you know, that the knight that comes into town carrying the baby, you know, swaddled in cloth. It's not just, you know, you can have a back world that influences, you know, things that take place in the PC's experience. At the same time, it's totally unnecessary, and you know, the beauty of the DCC RPG is it doesn't rely upon that, and it doesn't place more emphasis on that than on what the PCs do in response to and predicating these things.
I like that. It makes me think of the kind of dungeon world principle of draw maps but leave blank spaces. You know, it's like you can have like the basic outline of something set up before your game starts if you want to, but really kind of let there be space for you and your players to kind of fill it in with the actual story that you're telling.
Well, and that's the joy for us as judges, right? I mean, like, you know, the players do something you didn't imagine where they would take that ship at the end of, you know, Sailors, and wherever the hell they ended up is brand new to you, which is exciting to us as judges. Like, I could put them on an adventure path, and I know what we're going to do next month. Or I could let the players have agency. They take it wherever they go. I get to design a new place next month, and then in the month after that, we find they're on the purple planet, and it's still, you know, PCs are afforded so much freedom in DCC the RPG that it almost, you know, you need to take planning. You need to plan as much as you can, and then it's like parenting. You know, have a plan and be ready to let go of that plan any moment. those two things go hand in hand.
Now, do you feel like the parallels to Mystara were are these kind of intentional winky winky things? Because, you know, like, with Mystara, it was originally called The Known World, and then they had their Gazetteer series. And then also Mystara has a Hollow World, and now we have, you know, Journey to the Center of Aerith. I don't know. What do you think?
I appreciate you asking that question. You know, I was thinking, because I'm not a very intellectual writer, and so you know, the Known Realms was totally me. And then when I was thinking about that, I thought it was in response to the Forgotten Realms, like, ha, 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 winky, winky, these are the Known Realms, not the Forgotten Realms. But then you brought up... you brought up, you know, the Known World, and I was like, man, I bet that was in my backspace, too, as of, you know, just, like, floating around in 12-year-old Harley Stroh's brain, you know. Realms, Known...
Oh, that's hilarious.
But I think to the Hollow World piece, it's at this point it's more of us drawing off of the same source materials, as opposed to like way back when Into the Wilds. Golly, I don't even know what DCC that was anymore. Maybe 37 or something. that was definitely like that was my last. Not my last, but that was a DCC I wrote that was saying, man, this is, I remember what Keep on the Borderlands, Caves of Chaos gave to me as a kid. I want to write an adventure like that. But then there was definitely a truncated moment after that where it was like, no, I'm going to stop, you know, thinking about these TSR adventures that I loved as a child and writing an iteration of them. And I'm going to write adventures that draw upon the sources that inspired the adventures that I love. It's a very subtle nuance, but it's also, I think, core to how the DCC RPG came to be about. You know, we moved from, oh, TSR had a Giants adventure, let's write a Giants adventure, to, oh, something inspired TSR to make an adventure about Giants. Let's read that source text, and let's read whatever text that source text was based upon. And what does that inspire us to do? Well, maybe that has something to do with Giants, maybe it doesn't. But there's a very subtle shift there away from aping what came before and being like, wow, all right, let's dive into this. Let's be inspired by what inspired people we love.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. I love that.
And it really shows in your writing too, Harley.
Wow, thank you. You're very kind. I you know, I'm fortunate to be working for a company that gives us an incredible amount of freedom. You know, when it came to Aerith, you know, Joseph, you know, he didn't know me from Adam. I don't think we had even necessarily met in person at that point. And, you know, he's going to let me, you know, pick, you know, three or four other people, you know, Jeremy Simmons, you know, who's going to be our cartographer, and Jeff and Mike, and he's going to trust his world, his IP to us, and believe that we're going to make something that that, you know, that's going to work.
So in the spirit of the idea that, you know, you have these unique things that are living in the world of Aerith, there's no, you know, it's not ogres, it's like the ogre or whatever. I'm curious, are there any, like monsters or ideas from either old school D&D or new school D&D that you just think have like no place in the Aerith setting?
Well, if you were, I mean, it's a question of Aerith now or Aerith in 2006. And in 2006, it was entirely limited by the IP that Wizards wouldn't let us use. And so you're not going to sure. find any drow. You're not going to find any beholders.
Yeah, no mind flayers. No, right, I mean, on principle in the modern day, in the modern version of Aerith.
Then at that point, I default to, you shouldn't have seen any of them before. Like, none of them exist. And I know that's kind of a cop-out answer, I think there's so much, and I see this when I'm running games with my kids in the library, there's so much gained when they don't know what the hell they're dealing with.
Yeah.
When it's not a, they don't know if it's a drow elf or what have you. But the interesting piece is it doesn't preclude using any of those things. Because if you start to do your research, if you go back and see what inspired Gygax to write these hand crossbow-wielding elves that fled from the light creatures, like, you can get to something that's a core trope that could be really cool. Like, totally. there's nothing's off limits. It's just, don't be lame about it.
Yeah. It's like how I keep encountering wizards that heal at the Appendix Inn. Wait, sorry.
Wow.
Damn it, Jeff. Oops.
Did I do that again? I did it again.
We can't leave you anywhere.
Aside, are we going to see, like, in the house rules episode, are we going to see, like Jeff Goad's guide to merging clerics and wizards?
Oh, heck yeah, because in my campaign there is no cleric class, but all those spells still exist though.
And so is it, do you default to corruption or disapproval?
I guess you'll find out in the house rules section.
I'll be tuning in.
The spoiler though is corruption, because corruption is way more fun than
disapproval. Yeah, there's more variables.
Cool. Well, do you guys have anything else that you want to ask about Aerith before we move on?
I'm sorry, really quick point of just nerdery for me. From what you said earlier, Harley, was Tower of the Black Pearl, was that a 3.5 adventure in DCC first?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. It was a very short adventure included in The Adventure Begins, which was like a, excuse me, it was a collection of maybe 15, 20 smaller adventure compilations, or rather adventures that were compiled into a hardback. Yeah, maybe DCC 26. And I needed Evil Wizard, but that's the thing, like, God bless Joseph Goodman. Like, back in the day, like, there's this random kid, he's going to say, well, I have the worst wizard, ever known to the known realms. I'm going to misspell his name 14 times, but he permitted that capacity. Like, even back then we were trying to go big, like on Sailors, you're dealing with Chaos Lords. In Tower of the Black Pearl, you're dealing with, potentially, the vilest wizard to ever haunt the known realms. And so, our time as gamers is unfortunately so finite, like, go big, man. Like, Don't make them play with a two hit die, dragon. Like, just make it the worst dragon in the world and have them, toil to rebuild the world. I don't want to give the impression that this was solely my work. Just before the podcast, I texted Jeff a couple pictures from first, like, when Jeff LaSalle and I, we sat down and we drew, like, literally, like, just drew the outline of the continents, and then when we started to, like, slowly fill those continents in with place names, drawn from from the DCC adventures. And so, like, that whole back history of DCC authors, you know, and if they said, you know, this is a nation of horse kings, you know, who are fleeing, and, you know, the ogres from the north, like, we had to work that in. And so, you know, so between, you know, Jeff LaSala and Mike Ferguson, you know, and then Jeremy Simmons, who I want to say was it was his map work on Aerith that gave us our, you know, Goodman Games our first Emmy Award. You know, it wasn't me. It was this collection of DCC authors plus the three of us, four of us rather, you know, compiling this information and creating kind of a wiki world, for lack of a better term.
And just real quick, regarding that world map of Aerith, there is at goodman-games.com/Aerith an interactive map that contains all the spots where the old DCC and Punjar adventures took place within that map, and they list it by module number. I think that is really cool.
Yeah, that's Jeremy Simmons' work. He did some awesome stuff. And then I don't know if you guys can include it in the show notes, but you know, James Mishler of James Mishler Games, he did some quote unquote fan maps, like dealing with, like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Greyhawk, but like there's inside of Greyhawk the glossography, there's like a resource map, and there's a map of like alignments. And James Mishler went back and he took the maps that Jeremy Simmons had done and converted them to these really cool, old school, just sings to my soul maps,
like,
in the
like
same
Darlene style maps.
Not like Darlene style. No. You have to go even deeper than that. Go past.
Well, you
that
said Greyhawk.
Totally. And I understand. We all think of Darlene, but like, there's only, God bless her, there's only one Darlene. But In the actual Greyhawk, you know, not, I guess, I think it might have appeared in the folios. They do a very austere map depicting, like, you know, these regions are largely chaotic. These regions are lawful. These are neutral. This is where furs come from, this region. And anyhow, I don't know. It's just beautiful work that James did, like, way back in, like, 2006 that, he gave me on CDs back then that I was able to upload and hopefully, you know, you guys can share them in your show notes.
That's great. We would love to. And before we wrap up this section, I do have one kind of thought exercise for you. The assumed setting is kind of a medieval European setting ish, and I have a question. In the current version of Aerith, 1,000 years in the future of that setting, how much does it resemble the world we live in now?
that's a totally awesome question. That is a totally awesome question. So, if you'll indulge me, and you guys are giving me way too much time already. All right. Like, Harley Stroh, fourth grade. I don't know. How old are you in fourth grade? Like 9 or 10? Okay, so you go back to the world of Greyhawk, the glossography, and there's this introduction by Steve Winter alleging that the, you know, the history to the guide of the world of Greyhawk is real. And you know, fourth grade Harley Stroh believed that and and like was convinced, you know, for at least a couple years that, like, this document, like, you know, somehow grabbed by TSR and then converted into a game rules, was actually based on something historical. If you have the chance to read that preface or the foreword by Steve Winter, it's just awesome. And just know that there's a kid out there, me, who believed it. And so when Joseph Goodman comes to you and says, you know, all right, create a game world based upon, you know, these 30 adventures that I've helped publish. You know, that was, you know, Pluffett, you know, Smeasure the Elder. Like, that's what I wanted to impart to some, you know, third grader, fourth grader out there somewhere, was, like, close enough to, you know, what we could imagine, you know, as Earth. And you see that in Howard's, you know, Conan, too. Like, it mimics a lot of the coastlines and some of the cultures. And, you know, that's part of what I love about Conan. You know, and so yes. Are we the future Aerith? Absolutely. You know, at least as Harley wrote it for his you know, fourth grade counterpart.
But you can go way further than that to Punjar 40K, right?
Right, right. It's just not so the bad. Picture we want, the picture we all deserve.
Yes. There we go.
Yes.
And I think you know, like, you know, there's a part of me that, well, no, you know, one of my the people I admire most at Goodman Games, you know, looks at the world of Aerith and is like, ah, this is so profoundly boring. It's vanilla. This is not, you know, this offers me nothing in my gaming world. And, you know, and that's there's no truer, you know, this is a very familiar gaming world, and it's intended that way. You know, it was born out of a 30 plus DCCs that were intended to be, you know, dropped into any world. And so, you know, there's a lot of value and a lot to be improved upon. You know, like there's, we were talking earlier about player facing levers. You know, when we were working on Aerith, it was like, I was like, okay, you know, I want to make this just like this constellation, bear with me, this is a horrible metaphor, but a constellation of balloons that you know, players can throw darts at, and they're gonna choose, all right, that random purple dart that says, you know, ogre horde, you know, invading from the north, I want to throw a dart at that and see what happens. You're like, it's all intended, the strength of the setting is it can all be influenced by player character actions, it can all be transformed by player character actions. It's really this starting place for, you know, transforming the world into, you know, your vision. And you know, and part of that's, you know, what Doug has done with Punjar and its various iterations. You know, it's intended as a starting place, not as an ending place. Like, there's nothing canonical. Like, as soon as your PCs enter, the world should be transformed.
That's great. Nice. I love that.
I want to be a good little shill and say that the sequel to the World of Aerith for the prior DCC stuff kind of culminates in 91 with Journey to the Center of Aerith, right?
And that's pretty cool. I hadn't considered that, actually. Gotta remember, I don't remember anything I've written like the day after it's done.
Seriously, looking through this, the way it's laid out, you could use that as a tournament. Just saying. And the epilogue in and of itself, you know, Mysteries of the Inner Sea. Are we going back to Sailors Under the Starless Sea? I mean, it could happen. We've also got the Lairs of Lost Agartha and the Lost City of Barako, the tie-ins for it. And I will say my only complaints with these is that it does not delineate which author did each piece. I want to know who wrote this particular part because it's beautiful.
Well, now I think we know who we need to task with writing the essay about how the history of Aerith is real history as well.
Because Harley doesn't have enough writing projects, right?
No, Jen, I was recruiting you.
Oh,
exactly,
dude. I'm busy.
I think a good adventure should create mystery as opposed to solve it, and you know, and that, you know, like to so Journey to the Center was intended to do that. It's like, all right, let's go to the root of magic. You know, there's this source of primal, you know, magic power, and it's horribly wicked and evil and banal at the same time. And leave that wide open for judges to play upon.
Oh, and the Appendix N references are glorious.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry, I wouldn't be a proper shill without going through that. Okay.
Thank you, Jen. So that's a great note to wrap up. But before we do, Harley, I've heard rumors about something called like the DCC Academy or DCC College or something like that.
Oh, Jeff, thank you.
Are you able to tell us any more about this?
Yes. So, Master Brendan LaSalle and I will be hosting a seminar at Gen Con. Called, you know, right now we're calling it DCC College, you know, for lack of a better name, where we invite all judges, all aspiring judges, folks that would love to run DCC, come to the seminar, give us your questions. What are you worried about? What don't you know how to run? What keeps you awake at night? And so in anticipation of that event, of that seminar, we hope that I would love for any listeners to email me at, you know, Harley at, you know, goodman-games.com with any questions you might have, you know, concerns or questions. You know, Brendan and I can go through, try to answer them. And at the same time, Brendan and I are working on a similar project where we are looking for aspiring judges that would care to play in a game with Jeff, with Brendan and I, and are hoping, you know, to, well, they might be able to glean something from that. Which isn't to say that, you know, Brendan and I know BCC better than anybody else, but perhaps we have a little less fear or a little less concern with following the rules than other folks. So anyhow, if you have any questions about DCC, email me. If you would like to potentially play in an online game with Brendan and myself, I can't promise that we're going to be able to meet everybody's needs, but email, you know, again, Harley at goodman-games.com. And depending on how things shake out, perhaps, you know, Brendan and I can put something together before August to try to shake that out. Well, you know, we're really, there's, you know, DCC, just the more folks that are running the games, you know, the wider breadth of folks that are running the games, you know, the stronger our community is. You know, you guys spoke a little bit about that, you know, last episode. You know, how many people have been inspired by Jen running games? How many people have been inspired by Jeff running games? So talk to us if you have fears, you have apprehensions, let us
and bring maybe, us your questions. Maybe we could, like, get a recording of it or something, and, you know, host it or something.
Yeah,
you know,
that would be fantastic. Let's see what shakes out. And I know Brendan's really excited about it. I am. So reach out. Hopefully come to our seminar in August. But touch base with us before then. And
that sounds awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Like, if you'd like to be in an online game judged by Harley and or Brendan, or if you'd like us to send you a check for $1,000, or if you'd like a real life, you know, ring of invisibility, or if you'd, you know, yeah. Boy, sounds pretty good, actually. I think I may be sending an email, too.
Yeah, my fangirl's getting up here.
Oh, come on, guys.
Yeah, speaking of that.
The pieces, yeah, you guys know the secret already. It's like, you know, don't be worried about it. Just run the game. But
yeah,
you know,
you're kidding,
want
right?
To demonstrate that to folks. You know,
No, there are nerves and butterflies every damn time. No matter when or where.
Totally. I know. I still get them. And
that's adorable.
And oh, God. Are you kidding me,
Jen? At your kids' games?
God. It's horrible. if you can't find me at GaryCon on the years that I go, it's because I'm sitting in the hotel room, like, going over maps. Yeah, no. And none of it matters once you sit down with a group of players that, you know, just want to play the game. That's, yeah, like, we are so blessed as DCC gamers. Like,
yes.
Like, I've very rarely had a bad table. I don't know if I've ever had a bad table.
Yeah, that's
of
a good
folks
point.
That actually wanted to play DCC. You know, they show up and you're amongst friends that you've never met. You know, like, it's the same thing if you go to DugCon. Like, you just, like, you know, the most, you know, the bearded, tattooed, black leather wearing people that you never knew you loved until you showed up that night and they killed your character.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And then a meteor hit the earth.
that's the beauty of the DCC community. And it's something that Spellburn has helped build. And it's, you know, it's we are very fortunate. So let's get more.
Yes, we are.
Help, you know, Brendan and I make that happen.
And speaking of being fortunate, we've been very fortunate to have you on the show tonight, Harley. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real treat. Thank you.
All right. So I guess with that, we're done here.
You sure about that?
I guess. Well, I guess if you want to email us, you can email us at theband@spellburn.com.
That'd be good.
Woohoo!
That'd be cool.
Leave our ratings on iTunes.
Send us house rules. Send us house rules.
Yeah, send us house rules. Send us emails. Tweet at us. I don't know. Say hi to us on the street.
And if you want to play in Harley and Brendan's game, the emails go somewhere else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Send us to Harley.
Oh, thank you, guys. Have a wonderful night.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good night.
And game on.
Game on.
You've been listening to Spellburn. Copyright 2017. Our theme song has been graciously provided by Glitter Wizard. Learn more at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com.